Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Welcome to Cineversary, a podcast that celebrates a milestone anniversary of a masterful work of cinema. Every month, we send happy birthday wishes to a different film currently observing a joyous jubilee, from a 20th all the way up to a 100th anniversary. This, as ever, is your devoted host, Eric Martin, creator of the Cineverse blog and moderator of the weekly Cineverse Film Discussion Group. And hey, if you've just discovered our program, welcome. If you're a regular listener, we are delighted to have you back. 80 years ago, RKO Pictures released the follow-up to Citizen Kane, Orson Welles' debut work that many consider the finest film ever made. Welles' ambition was to top Kane by creating a picture that would visually astound, achieve new dramatic heights, and exceed the lofty expectations many had for his sophomore effort. But mixed reception from audiences during test previews propelled the studio to make drastic changes to the film while Welles was away in Brazil. Consequently, a shortened and thematically compromised version was released that flopped at the box office and damaged Welles' standing in Hollywood. But despite its abbreviated runtime and deviation from the director's intent, Amberson's has come to be regarded as among the greatest movies of all time. For this episode, I had the luck and privilege of being able to interview two outstanding guests. First up is film scholar and Welles expert James Naramore, author of The Magic World of Orson Welles. My talk with James will be followed by a chat with filmmaker Joshua Grossberg, director of the forthcoming documentary The Lost Print, The Making of Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons. Together, James, Joshua, and I will examine why The Magnificent Ambersons remains a cherished cinematic work, why RKO removed 43 minutes from the film, and how it significantly altered Welles' vision, and the current search for this elusive lost footage. Lots of great conversation to come, so put aside your concerns for a while, grab a comforting beverage, and join me and my guests as we pay proper homage to The Magnificent Ambersons, originally released on July 10, 1942. In advance of taking the scenic route on Amberson's dialogue with my guests, we need to do our due diligence and learn more about the making of this film, and for that task, we turn to Wikipedia. The Magnificent Ambersons is a 1942 American period drama written, produced, and directed by Orson Welles. Welles adapted Booth Tarkington's Pulitzer Prize-winning 1918 novel about the declining fortunes of a wealthy Midwestern family and the social changes brought by the automobile age. The film stars Joseph Cotten, Tim Holt, Agnes Moorhead, Dolores Costello, Ann Baxter, and Ray Collins, with Welles himself providing the narration. Welles lost control of the editing of The Magnificent Ambersons to RKO, and the final version released to audiences differed significantly from his rough cut of the film. A reported 43 minutes was trimmed out by the studio, which also shot and substituted a happier ending. Composer Bernard Herrmann insisted his credit be removed when, like the film itself, his score was heavily edited by the studio. Even in the released version, The Magnificent Ambersons is often considered as one of the best films of all time. The movie was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, and it was added to the National Film Registry of the Library of Congress in 1991. Today, The Magnificent Ambersons earns an 89% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, where its average critical score is 8.6 out of 10. Let's take a horse and carriage ride back in time now and soak in the audio for The Magnificent Ambersons' original theatrical trailer.
The Ambersons, literature's most fascinating family, brought to the screen by the magic of Orson Welles. Richard Bennett plays old Major Amberson, tyrannical head of a family that had all the rights of royalty, none of its responsibilities. Dolores Costello returns to the screen with a magnificent portrayal of Isabel, the Major's daughter, who left the man she loved to wed another who was more acceptable. From Citizen Kane, you will remember Agnes Moorhead, who plays thin, spinsterish Aunt Fanny, a lonely woman in a house of wealth.
No one would guess that Fanny had a secret love. Ray Collins is Uncle Jack, the black sheep of the Andersons. And Joseph Cotton, who plays Eugene Morgan, the man who came out of the past to find his first love once again. Finally, Isabel's boy, young George, played by Tim Holt, headstrong, impetuous, and arrogant heir to the splendor of the
world.
Young George, who hated Eugene Morgan, the man his mother really loved, and stood between their happiness like an avenging angel.
Don't you think you should tell George?
About us?
Yes.
You're not wanted in this house, Mr. Morgan.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Perhaps you'll understand this.
So scandal at last attacked the House of Amberson. Scandal spread by Isabel's own sister. Scandal spread by her own son, who broke into every house in town to make them take back the things they said about his mother. That high and mighty Amberson girl who fell in love just once too often. The Magnificent Ambersons brings you many of the Mercury players you first saw in Citizen Kane. It brings you Orson Welles as commentator, director, and producer of a truly distinguished and exciting motion picture.
If you've joined me previously, you know that this is the point in the podcast where we give fair warning about spoilers ahead. So if you're a self-respecting cineast who's not yet screened said film, it's time to amend that oversight. Otherwise, you might risk a scolding from Georgie Minifer.
Oh, look here. Don't do that.
Now that the Wells Appreciation Society is back at full strength, let's commence with the episode. Let's give a warm welcome to film scholar James Naramore, a longtime professor of film at Indiana University, now retired, who has studied and written expansively about Orson Welles and his filmography, as evidenced by his seminal text, The Magic World of Orson Welles. Among his other books are More Than Night, Film Noir and Its Contexts, Acting in the Cinema, and An Invention Without a Future, Essays on Cinema. You can also hear Jim's voice on the Blu-ray and DVD audio commentaries for The Magnificent Ambersons, Citizen Kane, Touch of Evil, and Mr. Arkadin. Jim, so glad you are aboard for this episode of Cineversary. Thanks ever so much for gracing us with your presence and your expertise.
Thank you very much.
So let's get into this. It is the 80th birthday thereabouts of The Magnificent Ambersons, and all the more reason to celebrate this milestone. So how is this movie important to you personally, and where does it rank for you among Welles' filmography?
Well, I've been asked twice now to participate in the Sight and Sound poll that happens every 10 years. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're familiar with that, where they come up with votes for the 10 best films of all time. And you're asked to send 10 titles to them. The first time I did it, I listed Touch of Evil. And the second time, I listed Citizen Kane, but that was only because I didn't want Kane to fall any further in the rankings. Mm. But I left a note saying that I could just as well have said The Magnificent Ambersons. I think Welles has made at least four of the best films of all time, and Ambersons is one of them.
Would the fourth be Chimes at Midnight, I would venture?
Chimes at Midnight, yeah. And Ambersons and Kane and Touch of Evil. Yeah.
Mm, right. But yeah, no, you are not alone. You are not out on a limb there with your vote, I would assume, because Ambersons has certainly climbed the ranks among the greatest films of all time. So, Jim, why does The Magnificent Ambersons still matter 80 years later? How do you think it has stood the test of time, and why is this movie worth celebrating?
Well, I think it's one of the best movies ever made. Mm. So it has stood the test of time. It certainly is far more admired today than it was when it was first released. RKO at that time wanted to get rid of Welles. You may know that they previewed it well along with a Dorothy L'Amour film or something. And they claimed that, you know, it got really, really bad notices from the audience. I've read those notices, and while some people don't like it, a lot of people in them say they think it's the best movie they've ever seen.
Yeah.
But the reviewers were mixed about it. Manny Farber didn't like it. Mm-hmm. I don't think James Agee reviewed it. And it was a flop at the box office because RKO messed it up with the editing, but they didn't distribute it correctly.
Yeah, didn't really promote it. And they kind of made it the second of a twofer bill, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, serious admirers of Welles have always thought that it was a masterpiece. He delivered a masterpiece and they didn't like it. It's not only not lost that stature, it's gained it as time has gone on.
So, yeah, I mean, 80 plus years, this is all we really have to go on. And again, we can hold out hope that the lost footage is found, but assuming it's not, this is what we got.
Right. But fortunately, we do know what it was like originally.
That's right. In fact, I didn't see it, but I know that they did a version for television. I don't know if you saw this. I think it was a BBC production where they tried to follow Wells's vision. Did you see this?
Yeah, it's quite good.
Yeah. And so it kind of gives you a flavor of what the 1942 film might have been like. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
For my take, Jim, yeah, I mean, it could be Orson Welles' best work. I mean, at least it might have been, if not tampered with by RKO, right? So even in its altered form and with its tacked-on happy ending, which, by the way, approximates the finale in Booth Tarkington's novel to some extent, it still remains an incredible picture. In case you were curious, I didn't read the book, but from what I gather, Welles' intended finale featured Eugene visiting a diminished Fanny in a boarding house, which we learn in the final shot is actually the Amberson Mansion. Tonally, this would have been a much more somber and elegiac denouement than the conclusion we currently have, in which Eugene and a healthier Fanny, they visit George recovering in a hospital where Lucy is by his side. The two men reconcile their differences, and it's suggested that Eugene will financially provide for George and Fanny. So they tacked on this happy ending.
Yes, right. In fact, the last shot of the movie would have been Joseph Cotten exiting the place where he's been talking to Fanny. Mm-hmm. And we realize at that point that it's the old Amberson Mansion, now a boarding house for elderly people. As he leaves, the camera goes back and we see Cotten surrounded by the smoky, grimy city.
Yes. Anyway. Right, which is another theme. The desecration, if you will, of this cherished old burg.
Yes, yeah.
But I would argue that it has also stood the time because it isn't afraid to be dark and downbeat, despite the tacked-on happy ending. It's prescient in its cautionary messages about how technological progress cannot be stopped and how industrial innovation and a faster-paced modern world has significant cultural and societal repercussions. This is one of the first Hollywood motion pictures, you could make a case, that tackles the topic of the rapid industrialization of early 20th century America and the replacement of the privileged aristocracy from the bourgeoisie or, you know, upper middle class.
Yes, I would totally agree with that. And one thing that RKO's editing of the film did was cut out a lot of the sort of social and economic aspects of the film. Mm. They concentrated more on the love story aspect of the film. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine that audiences would have been appreciative of that theme in 1942, right in the middle of the war.
That's right.
Than they are today. As you say, it was prescient, but in a way, that theme was always with Welles. In a sense, it's even a little in Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the timing of the movie, you bring up a good point, which is, you know, we had just entered into World War II as the country. Right. And of course, it was, you know, gung-ho, rah-rah, rally around the troops, and let's all pitch in to defeat, you know, the Axis powers. And that involved, you know, making sacrifices, you know, going to work at factories and getting behind the machine industrial complex.
Yes.
Which is kind of a contrarian thought to many of the themes of the movie. So unfortunately, the timing of this, as far as the tone and the messages of the film, it may not have been quite in sync with the public in America at the time.
Yeah.
I think it further matters because many of the characters and performances are superb, especially to me anyway. Agnes Moorehead as Aunt Fanny is just outstanding here. Some regard her portrayal as one of the first contemporary cinematic representations of a neurotic, hysterical woman.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary performance. Agnes Moorehead, in my view, was one of the greatest actors who ever lived. Mm. You know, she's just got one small scene in Citizen Kane, but you can't get it out of your mind.
That's right. She steals it.
In this film, she's just indelible. The character she plays, Fanny Minifer, we need to keep in mind, is a Minifer, not an Amberson. She's a, mm-hmm. she's the sister of Wilbur Minifer. And so she's kind of a left out person in the family. She's also a little more kind of middle class, and though this doesn't come through with the edit, a little more frugal and puritanical. And as a Minifer, she's sort of tolerated by the family, mm-hmm. but she really has nothing but her crush on Eugene Morgan. And of course, that's repressed in all kinds of sexual ways. And that performance just teeters on the edge of madness. Every time she's on the screen, you can't take your eyes off of her. She's stunning in this film.
No question about it. I think perhaps most of all, Magnificent Ambersons is worth celebrating for the elite filmmaking craft involved. I mean, especially for 1942, Welles continued to experiment with the innovative approaches he and his collaborators first adopted in Citizen Kane, including, let's go down the list here, because there's several noteworthy points. Of course, deep focus photography. Here he has Stanley Cortez as his cinematographer, not Greg Tolan, but together they create these striking compositions in which the frame is often carefully designed to feature multiple planes of focus and interest. I think of this early shot of the gossiping kind of Greek chorus townspeople that layers them across the foreground, middle ground, and background as a good example of that. You have chiaroscuro lighting, the shadow-heavy cinematography that is quite distinctive. You've got silhouettes and half-lit figures that occasionally are used to great dramatic effect. Those spring to mind, Jim. You know, grandiose camera movement, the elaborate crane shots and the fluid tracking shots. I think a fine example of the latter is in the Ambersons ball sequence, right, where the camera seamlessly weaves between dancing and walking characters. And from what I understand, they kind of cut up that scene too, right? It was meant to be more extensive and elaborate. But at least what we still have is pretty visually impressive.
Yeah, I agree. Stanley Cortez had mainly been working in B movies when mm-hmm. Welles hired him. And Welles wanted for this film a photographer who could work fast, because Tolan was a very meticulous photographer. And so Welles is worried about the schedule. So he hires Cortez, and then suddenly Stanley Cortez becomes Greg Tolan. He wants to be just what Welles needs, and he's going very slowly. And as a result of that, he didn't photograph a lot of the film. Three other photographers did, Richard McKenzie, Russell Betty, mm-hmm. and Harry Wild. It's Welles's visual sense that is determining the photographic style of the film. And Welles knew just where to put the camera. Mm-hmm. He knew just how he wanted it lighted.
Yeah, that's a good point to keep in mind. Tolan was his first choice, but if I'm not mistaken, Tolan was not available. The schedule didn't sync with what they were doing, right?
Yeah, according to Richard Wilson, who was the associate producer, he told me they wanted somebody not like Tolan who could work fast.
Okay.
But anyway, that's what happened. In terms of the camera movements, not only is the great party scene messed with. One of the things you lose there is the sense of the different social classes in the town. Mm-hmm. But also toward the end, when George returns to the Amberson mansion and has his prayer beside his mother's bed, gets his comeuppance, Cortez would have, he did a scene. I'm not sure whether Welles liked it or not, but it was a very elaborate tour with a moving camera of the entire Amberson mansion, going through downstairs, upstairs, through the rooms, sometimes doing a 360-degree pan so that you would see all four walls.
You're saying the scene where George is alone in the empty mansion, right?
That's so right.
It's kind of showing that the abandonment, the desolation, right, the shadows, the kind of haunting nature of what this family estate has become.
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow. But yeah, I want to finish this thought about, you know, some of the innovative techniques that he had started with Kane and continued or expanded upon in Ambersons. So yes, the grandiose camera movement, the fluid tracking shots, but also long unbroken shots. Now, I really paid more attention to it on the most recent rewatch of Ambersons. I think these long, you know, uninterrupted takes, they keep the audience intently focused on the characters and the acting without breaking the rhythm of the scene or their performance. I think of the 4-minute sequence in the kitchen where Fanny is feeding George, or when Lucy and George's carriage ride, you know, goes through town, as good examples of that.
Yeah, I think one of the differences between Ambersons and Kane mm-hmm. is a lot of visual razzle-dazzle.
Yes.
And it tends to alternate between rapidly edited scenes and long takes. The camera moves more in Ambersons, but in the still scenes, like the one you're talking about where Fanny feeds George, that was supposed to last longer. At the end of stuffing down the strawberry shortcake, there's a thunderstorm going outside, and Jack walks over to the window and looks outside. He says, "Holy cats." And what's happening is that the whole backgrounds of the place are being dug up for a housing project. So anyway, some of the long takes would have been even longer.
Wow, that's incredible to think about. Maybe would have been groundbreaking for the time in terms of expecting patience and tolerance from the audience without breaking the shot or moving the camera or cutting to a different point of view. Or
one of my favorites is the dinner scene, where which is a long take, where Joseph Cotten talks about how the coming of the automobile will change men's minds. And it has one of the greatest uses by an actor of an object that I can think of in film, that I can think of only one other that I like as well. He's holding a spoon in his hand.
Right.
And as he contemplates the future, his thumb is rubbing that spoon. And you get the feeling that while he is a representative of the future, he's a little worried about it. It's a nice touch.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to venture to guess what that other movie actor is. Is it Brando in On the Waterfront?
Yeah, the famous glove scene there. But the one I was going to mention was Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove.
Ah, okay.
Where he's talking to Sterling Hayden about how he was in a Japanese prisoner camp. And Hayden's got his big arm around him. And Sellers is very nervous, is playing with a chewing gum wrapper.
That's right.
As he talks about all those Japanese. Boy, they make great cameras, though, he says.
Yes. Oh, you're piquing my interest all over again. Now I want to watch Strangelove. Anyway, 6 degrees of separation. But a few other innovative things to take note of. This film, as in Kane, you've got a very sophisticated sound design. I mean, this is evidenced by, like, the overlapping dialogue. You can notice some variations in volume based on the speaker's location to the camera, echo effects, things like that. Are there other examples of the sound design sophistication that spring to mind for you?
For me, the most interesting one is the sleigh ride in the snow.
Okay.
The character starts singing The Man Who Broke the Bank at Monte Carlo. The relation between Herman's music and the sound effects, the puttering car, if you listen to that sometime, it's a remarkable piece of sound editing. When Fanny is talking to George in the hallway of the mansion early in the film, she's shadowed. There's a kind of a peacock shadow behind her head, and they're talking, and she gets louder, and they're both arguing with each other. And Uncle Jack, you hear him down the hallway saying, "Will you please be quiet? I'm going to move to a hotel." And he's off somewhere in the distance.
Right. Kind of another example of like echoey effects or like, you know, different volume variations. Yeah. And you get a spatial kind of sense of the audio distance, too, which is really cool for a 1942 film. Yeah. A couple others that really are top of mind here as far as innovative effects or filmmaking approaches. Little winks to the past here with silent cinema techniques. I think in keeping with the nostalgic tone of the narrative, Wells employs antique effects like think of the iris openings and closings here. And in the prologue, you have a gauzy lens with blurred corners of the frame, and that harkens back to the look of silent movies and even vintage photographs. It's meant to be kind of wistful, nostalgic in terms of a visual approach. It is pretty interesting and effective. And then I was really struck by the creative end credits. Instead of using traditional text or a screen crawl or something like that, Wells verbally recognizes the cast and the crew, and he presents shots of the actors' faces looking at the camera. And I can't recall another film that closes in this manner. Can you? I mean, was this the first time something like that had been done?
Citizen Kane ends with running through the cast.
Yes.
But if I remember correctly, all of the shots of the cast at the end are lines that the actors speak. And
that's right.
And so they are from the film. Here, it's more like portrait shots. And these were done, apart from the film.
But the combination of that, where they're actually looking at the lens, so breaking the fourth wall, and footage not used in the movie, as well as the verbal crediting. Yeah. I don't know if that combination had ever been done before.
I don't know. It's what... In Wells's mind, it was like a curtain call at the end of a play.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's curtain call credits. And this is the only movie in which Wells, except The Other Side of the Wind, in which Wells doesn't act. Of course, he just serves as the narrator. And I love the shot at the end of the microphone. I'm Orson Welles, and the microphone boom goes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, he also with the credit. He makes the credits entertaining. It used to be when I was a kid and went to the movie, when the credits come on, I'd get up and walk out. But the audience sticks around for these. And he shows the machinery. One of the people who was tremendously important for Welles at RKO was a man named Vernon Walker, who okay. did the kind of shots where you can combine two images and make them look like one.
Yeah, composited images.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He shows the apparatus when he mentions Vernon Walker's name.
Yes, that is very, very interesting, especially for an early 40s film where, like you said, it's like they don't show how the sausage is made very often. So, and yes, to your point of a moment ago, yes, this is the sole movie Wells helmed in which he doesn't appear on screen. It's only his narrating voice that can be heard. I've maintained this with other guests where we've talked about Wells. I think his greatest talent, bar none, was his voice. His famously booming baritone. Here, it kind of takes a back seat, and it's a more subdued vocalization in which his cadence, his timbre, his tone combined to convey kind of a pensive and restrained omniscience. So it's not, I mean, he could have come across as very bombastic with, you know, his voice here and really tried to capture the audience in a grandiose way, but he doesn't. And I think that it's appropriate for the tone of the film, especially the nostalgic feel in the beginning. And you don't hear his voice throughout the movie. It's not like it's incessantly narrated.
That's right. It's mainly at the beginning.
Right. But it is very effective, and you know immediately that it's Wells. I'm sure in the day people knew that.
Of course. He was very famous on the radio. So
that's correct. Yeah, Voice of the Shadow and everything else.
And he does just a wonderfully sensitive reading of Tarkington. Those words come from Tarkington's novel.
Yes. Just to finish this thought, and then I want to get into more about what you learned in researching and writing about Wells. I want to read you a quote here. This is by Jay Hoberman from The Village Voice. He said that the film language in Amberson's is more fluid and adept than Kane's. The expressionist lighting is more rigorously modulated. The astonishingly choreographed Christmas ball that serves to introduce the major characters is arguably the greatest set piece of Wells' career. The highly rehearsed ensemble is sensational. Not even Kane made more effective use of dramatic sound. Again, and with greater subtlety, there are Wells' trademark overlapping dialogue, his construction of oral deep space, a brooding Bernard Herrmann score, and the clever deployment of a naturalistic Greek chorus. Most remarkable, however, is the voice. The movie is haunted by Wells' voice, by his youth, and by a sense of a lost America that he would never again visit, and mainly by its own lost possibilities.
I agree with all of that, but I would say that it seems to me that Amberson's is Wells' most personal film. It not only uses a theme that recurs in his films, but it has to do very much with his own lost youth in the Midwest. What Wells said was that Eugene Morgan was based on his father, Dick Wells. Mm, and people have scoffed at that. They say, oh, don't be silly. Tarkington couldn't possibly have known Dick Wells, but Tarkington did know Dick Wells. Dick Wells had a hotel in Grand Decatur, Illinois, where Tarkington probably had dinner. So I wouldn't be surprised if Dick Wells weren't in Tarkington's mind when he wrote the novel. And that idea, it's a sentimentalized, a nostalgia, but it's also critical of that past. But Wells was again and again, his films have to do with time, with a lost time, a decline. The magic of the first part of the film makes you really regret that.
It's an interesting point about his father and maybe some relations to the author there and how that would have tied in thematically to the movie or what Wells was trying to do. I'd love to talk to you more here about themes in a moment. But first, I just want to delve a little bit with you into, you know, some noteworthy things maybe you learned in researching and writing about Amberson's and about Wells, for that matter, that maybe you'd like to share with the listeners here. So when you took a deeper dive and you really studied the movie and the director, what were some things that you learned that you were fascinated by?
Well, my book on Wells consists of, I think, two things: close readings of the films. So when I was writing the book, I was looking at the films over and over again, trying to be sort of detailed about them. I did do a lot of research. I know, for example, that the ball, the big ball at the beginning of the film, used three sound stages, about 9,000 items of decor.
Wow!
And one of the lost things there is the fluidity of the camera movement, because the RKO cut into it a lot. But it's important that the camera move from one scene to another, mm-hmm. because it's like touring the belly of a whale. I mean, you want to get a sense of the hugeness and the substantialness of the Amberson world. And that design is so marvelous. It's ridiculous in many ways. It's a kind of a kitsch Xanadu, which is already a kitsch place. I learned some production details like that.
Okay. Yeah. Anything else just in terms of overall composite picture of Wells and his work here that you came away maybe impressed by or had a different take after researching, studying more intently?
I don't think my research fundamentally changed my attitude about the film.
Okay.
It gave me some insight into some details.
Sure.
I would agree with Hoberman and also Francois Truffaut, who said that Wells as director of Amberson's was trying to teach the director of Citizen Kane a lesson. And in technical terms, I think that's correct.
Yeah, a lot of people say that Amberson's has a bit more heart than Kane. And you mentioned it's a more personal movie, but I think perhaps it's a movie, even in its 88-minute form, that maybe is more accessible to audiences emotionally.
Maybe so. One of the truly great things about the film, and it's typical of Wells, it's a great example of what George Lukács and Frederick Jameson have called the model of historical novel. And the best historical novels involve a conflict between a dominant form of society and a newly emergent different form of society. The characters are situated along those lines. And during the thing, the emergent world, you know, takes over. But the narrative doesn't take sides. I think we sympathize with Eugene Morgan, but he's a representative of something the film is criticizing.
That's true.
And I think we sympathize in some ways with the Ambersons. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, they are ridiculous, and the film is criticizing them, too. So it involves a much more mature audience. It needs an audience that realizes this is not going to give you the standard effects of melodrama.
Yeah, well said. What is it about Wells as an artist, or as a human being, for that matter, that continues to fascinate you? Why is he still such a subject of intrigue for you and so many other scholars?
Well, for me, I never met Wells. A lot of the other scholars did meet Wells. So I can't speak to him as a person. He certainly had his flaws, but I have always admired his politics. I think those politics are really part of what makes his art great. I think people don't realize it in Amberson's because of the way the movie is cut. Kane is very obviously a political movie. Amberson's is less in your face about it, but it's important. And Wells was always a political activist. At some point, in fact, he even had ambitions to be in politics himself. Mm-hmm. I admire that, and I admire his extraordinary intelligence and well-readiness and taste.
Sure. But as a filmmaker, especially compared to other directors who you admire, what stands out about his talents, his aptitudes, his approach to filmmaking style that really sets him apart? Is there something you put a finger on there?
I don't know. I don't know if he can be set apart from every director. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are other great directors, but he has obviously a very distinct style. Some people don't like it because it's very show-offy. Sometimes it's not. His best known films are that way. He had an enormously good visual sense. The only other director who has, I think, also a really great visual sense is in that period, in the older classic Hollywood period, is John Ford. But Ford is sentimental in a way that Wells is not. And because Wells was an artist, he drew, he painted, he originally was going to be a painter. He has an extraordinary sense of composition, and the shots in his films can be mesmerizing. Truffaut once said that Wells shoots like an exhibitionist and edits like a censor. and there are many times in his films where you feel, oh, that shot is so powerful, but he won't leave it on there terribly long. Hmm. And he had a full technical knowledge of the movies. After Citizen Kane, he was telling the photographers what to do. That combined with what I call the intelligence, the narrative sense, and especially the theatricality that all mm-hmm. movies involved. He was talented in all those levels.
Yeah, it's so interesting to trace the arc of his filmography and his career. Of course, after Amberson's, maybe with the exception of Touch of Evil and a couple others, really, he isn't given the keys to the kingdom anymore. He has to work very hard to even get the graces of a studio to, you know, give him the resources to make a movie. And most of his work after Amberson's is independent filmmaking, you know, at its grittiest, at its rawest. So maybe he serves as a patron saint of sorts in some ways to, you know, the independent film movement. But it's just interesting how Amerson's is the demarcation line for how his career changes afterward.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In both Touch of Evil and The Lady from Shanghai, and even in The Stranger, he has the benefit of the studio technology in Hollywood. Yeah. So he can do some remarkable things with that. Afterwards, he has to do it himself. And he is a pioneer of what we think of today as independent art cinema. He began doing this in the 1950s with the films like Othello, and he would act and make money acting and then stick it into the film that he was trying to make. But he was an independent art film director before there was an infrastructure of theaters and distribution systems for that kind of cinema. If he were alive today and had the benefit of digital cameras and all the paraphernalia that an independent filmmaker has, I almost weep to think of what he could do with all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a tantalizing thought, no question. I want to delve briefly into films or filmmakers that might have been influenced by Amberson's in its wake. It's possible that Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, which was released a year later, took a thematic cue or two from Magnificent Amberson's, at least in how it depicts the dark truths that fester inside a beloved small town. Others cite Luchino Visconti's equally nostalgic The Leopard as a work inspired by Amberson's. Now, I've not seen that, but it has been brought up in the research I gathered. If you look at Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums, that seems to be kind of a natural inheritor to an Amberson's-like vibe and feel to some extent. You think about the characters in the story, or even the title, The Royal Tenenbaums, it seems to take a cue from Amberson's. And we talked about that. There was a 3-hour cable version of Amberson's shown in 2002 that followed Wells' shooting script. And I think that's a testament to the allure of the lost cut of the film. And then Wells himself revisited Amberson's class conflict and glory fading themes in his later Chimes at Midnight. So maybe there's a bit of a through line there. Can you think of any other examples of directors, movies, or otherwise that might have been influenced by this film?
There is one film that is specifically alludes to Amberson's, and it's Peter Bogdanovich's The Last Picture Show. The last scene in The Last Picture Show is Bogdanovich's version of the lost last scene in Amberson's.
I never thought about it that way.
Yeah,
wow.
You have Cloris Leachman and
Timothy Bottoms.
Yeah, Timothy Bottoms, right. And they're sitting in a kitchen of a kind of a drab house, and they're talking about the events we've seen. And it's a kind of a sad ending. And in the background is a record player that's playing a song in the background. And that's exactly the way the conversation between Eugene and Fanny worked in Amberson's. There was a record playing in the background, an old joke record from vaudeville called Two Black Crows.
Ah.
And, Bogdanovich knew that, and he specifically nodded to Amberson's there.
Okay, it's time to dig into messages, themes, or morals explored in Amberson's. Now, I've got a laundry list of possibilities here I'd love to explore with you, but I first want to hear what you have to say. So what rises to the surface for you as far as a message or a theme, Jim?
Well, I think I've already indicated that time is a big issue in the film. Even the ball scene where Eugene comes in and he's dancing with Dolores Costello, and he says, there aren't any times but new times. And they're doing a kind of a ragtime dancing forward. And then George and Lucy step in, and George says, I don't want to have an ordinary job. I want to be a yachtsman. They dance backward.
That's right.
And the whole conversation at the party is about memories, times, how things change with time. Even the blocking of the film, there's a kind of an instability or change that emphasizes that. And for Wells, I think that was a very deeply important theme. He's very much interested in this idea of time changing people and affecting people. For me, that's the guiding theme of the film. In terms of morality, I don't know. In terms of politics, I think he's, as we've just said, offering a critique both of the old foolish aristocracy and of the dangers of the new modern world, which is going to be, and this is what was lost in the cutting a lot, I think. The old world was the one, prosperity came from land, cattle, things like that. In the new economy, it has to do with paper money, with investments, with industrialization.
Yes.
And one of the reasons that the Ambersons lose their money, and we again, it has to do with stuff that was cut from the movie, they make bad investments, and their property loses its value. Whereas Eugene Morgan has been in the East for a while and he's made smart investments and he prospers. But it is that change from high capitalism, from a kind of a more, agricultural thing. By the way, Tarkington's novel is based on a specific place in Indianapolis. It's called it's called Woodruff Place. I've been there. Today, it is. It looks like a kind of a funky, semi-bohemian neighborhood. But at the time, that's where the richest people in town lived.
Okay.
Tarkington wrote part of the novel there.
Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. I completely agree with your thematic reading of the film. I'd like to extrapolate on it a bit. I think, to me, it stands out so clearly that time and progress cannot be halted. Most of the movie suggests that the Ambersons are doomed to financial failure, to ignominy and irrelevance, because they cannot adapt to modernization and changing economic, social, and cultural paradigms. It seems to me they can't move forward. As you said, you know, you see this scene during the ballroom sequence where Eugene, he's symbolically on the dance floor, he's whisking Isabel out of frame, but he's moving forward. And instead, the Ambersons move backward. As you said, George literally moves backward when he dances with Lucy. That's such a symbolic kind of representation of this idea. And this, to me, it implies that living in the past and ignoring what's to come is dangerous. Here I'm going to read you, this is David Alexander of The Guardian in his review of the movie. He said, as modernity surrounds the Amberson mansion, Wells brings the film's focus ever more tightly into this big old house. Soon we find we are trapped there, entombed in an architectural anachronism. The last third of the film keeps the action largely in this setting as it puts the Amberson family through a final round of humiliation. And then, as you were discussing with me, the negative consequences of innovation, of technological progress, certainly emerges as a reading of the movie. And this intimates to me that focusing only on the future while forgetting the past, the lesson here is, yeah, that's dangerous. And that's a concept that's kind of contrary to the previously posited theme. Remember how the narrator comments in the film's opening. He says how in those days they had time for everything and how the streetcar is too slow for us nowadays because the faster we're carried, the less time we have to spare. And I think these remarks are prophetic because nowadays, despite all our high-tech rapid advancements designed to make life more efficient and easy, we seem to have less time than ever, Jim, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That seems a bit prescient and prophetic.
Right. Modernity is speed. It's all about speed. Mm-hmm. Making more money by going faster.
Right.
Making things convenient by going faster. It's to a hyper extent now.
Totally.
Yeah. In terms of the last parts of the film, as the film goes along, there's a whole period where it's kind of lugubrious. You don't feel any release from it. So that it's a kind of a downer. And this has to do also with the way RKO cut the film. For example, there's a scene of Jack saying goodbye to George at a railroad station. Mm-hmm. It's just still long take. Camera's not moving. It originally lasted a little longer to show Jack borrowing $100 from George. But that was followed by a very elaborate montage showing George walking down National Avenue, touring the decrepit Amberson mansion. And that scene was going to be followed by Fanny's hysteria in the kitchen.
Oh, that would have flowed so much better, everything you're describing.
And then came the slowly paced conversation between Eugene and Lucy in their garden. So in other words, the structure of the film was affected when they did the cutting.
Totally. Yeah. I just want to quote briefly Eugene, what he says after George's insult about automobiles being a useless nuisance. Yeah. I'm not sure George is wrong about automobiles. With all their speed forward, they may be a step backward in civilization. It may be that they won't add to the beauty of the world or the life of men's souls. It may be that in 10 or 20 years from now, if we can see the inward change in men by that time, I shouldn't be able to defend the gasoline engine, but would have to agree with George that automobiles had no business to be invented. He's being very honest there.
Yeah.
It is revelatory about his character that not only is he being honest, but possibly less sympathetic. But by being honest, he becomes more sympathetic to me, even though he stands for this industrialization that may start to dehumanize the human race. So as you were talking about earlier, there are some ironic kind of contradictory elements thematically that play off each other here. And characters can be both sympathetic and non-sympathetic. And that, I think, is a good example of that.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would also add that while the film may have a subtle critique of nostalgia. By the end of the film, everybody is living in the past.
Yes.
The last scene, which would have been that discussion between Eugene and Fanny, it would be full of all kinds of ironies given the relationship between those two.
Oh, it would have been a delicious irony at the end. Yes.
But even even earlier, during the snow ride sequence, the sleigh ride, which is one of the most wonderful scenes in the movie.
Agreed.
Gene is talking to Isabel and they talk about they're remembering the old days. So Gene, too, is nostalgic for some time in the past when he
certainly
when he was courting her and all that.
Right. But of course, his famous quote really stands out. When times are gone, they're not old, they're dead.
Yeah.
There aren't any times but new times.
Yeah.
Really, you know, kind of supersedes anything else. But you are right. Even he is nostalgic.
Yeah.
And so a couple other themes here. Tragedy and misfortune certainly rise to the top here. This is the tale of a downfall of a respected blue blood American family, as well as the unsettling transformation of a location from a beloved quaint hometown to an unsightly modern and mechanized city where past cherished charms, they've kind of been swept away, right? And so it's also a story of romantic catastrophe in which a good man is prevented from marrying his true love. A spoiled offspring is jilted by the woman of his affection. A meddling spinster doesn't get the man of her dreams, at least until the tacked on happy ending. But and then like a classic Greek tragedy, there is a Greek chorus of sorts in the form of the gossiping townsfolk we see. So misfortune, tragedy certainly, you know, stands out as a thematic possibility here. You can't deny that this is a redemption story to some extent. I mean, George is finally humbled in the end. He's forced to work for a living. He's found kneeling in prayer for forgiveness for his actions. And to me, anyway, that makes him a more sympathetic character by the conclusion. But yes, poetic justice has been served, has it not, in the form of an automobile accident that sends him to the hospital. And I think that this cosmic reprimand combined with his mea culpa, maybe it means that he's now worthy of being absolved by Eugene and loved by Lucy. At least maybe that's what the studio intended by recutting this film here. So I assume Wells's vision, he is not reunited with Lucy. Is that fair to say?
There may be an intimation of that in the conversation that Eugene has with Fanny in the rooming house.
Okay.
But no, the ending, which RKO gave to the film, is more like Tarkington, but it isn't completely like Tarkington. In Tarkington, the three characters are George, Lucy, and Eugene. Fanny is not there.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, they wanted to make it a kind of romantic happy ending. In terms of George, I think people always criticize Tim Holt. I like him in the film. I think he resembles the young Orson Welles in some ways. But his performance, some of the best parts of his performance were cut out of the film.
Yeah, I've wondered it because what we're left with, it's still good.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that it's not complete. We're not given the whole picture, and we would probably feel even more sympathetic or allegiant toward
him. Well, I don't know if we would feel sympathetic, but I think what the original film does is introduce an Oedipal theme, a strong thing between George and his mother.
I still sense it there, even in the truncated cut. Yeah, it's still there. But
you sense it. But there's a conversation between George and his mother, which is really badly shot. It was obviously done by some other director in the film. And the original version of that, Holt actually quotes Hamlet. "'Tis not my inky cloak, good mother," he says to her. There was more dramatic intensity in what Holt did in some of these scenes that were reshot.
Okay. Yeah, just to round out the thoughts here, complex familial dynamics, intergenerational struggles, these are thematic chunks to digest. There are three generations of Amersons who face challenges in coexisting together in this story. You can make a case that the naivete, the rudeness, the stubborn nature of George, who embodies the youngest generation, maybe that insinuates that the magnificence of the Amberson line is passing. But to me, his comeuppance and his peacemaking with Eugene at the conclusion, it implies that George can redeem himself in his family's name. I don't know if that, you know, is as satisfying as what Wells had intended, but in any event, just for George's character, it's an interesting kind of transition. Class conflict is a theme here. The Ambersons is a study of the clash between gentry elites represented by the Amberson family and maybe a clash between them and the upwardly mobile middle class that will replace them. And that's exemplified by Eugene and his daughter. And then I was really fascinated on this most recent rewatch by examining the interesting romantic and familial dynamics, Jim, because to me, Amberson presents two unusual love triangles. The first between Isabel, Eugene, and George. And the second involving Lucy, Eugene, and George. The narrative centerpiece of this tale concerns the competition between George and Eugene for Isabel's affection, But there's also, as you mentioned, this thinly veiled Oedipal relationship between George and Isabel, who spoils her son. And likewise, Lucy has a close, if not kind of comparable, Electra-like relationship with her father. And I think there's an intriguing symmetry between several groups of characters here because, you know, ponder that Isabel is a widow with a son, just as Eugene is a widower with a child of his own. The widow and the widower are drawn to each other, as are their adult children. And then there are two secondary characters, and they are George's paternal aunt and maternal uncle, and they help to expand the intergenerational dynamics of the family story. And it's interesting to me that Fanny and Jack each get roughly equal screen time, give or take. In the cut we have, it's just interesting that there's some symmetry between the relationships here. I found it much more interesting most recently watching this again. Now, I have to ask you, Jim, do you view this as a masterwork that excels despite its unfortunate tacked-on conclusion and its truncated runtime? Or is this cut of Amberson's forever diminished because of these factors? So how do you kind of reconcile this?
I can only speak for myself personally. Mm-hmm. The first time I ever saw Amberson's, many, many, many years ago, I'm a pretty old geezer, I saw it on a television set. I had to leave. I couldn't watch the whole movie. But it came on. I'd never heard of it before. I was maybe a freshman in college. I don't know. I don't remember. And it was that opening scene, you know, with the townspeople and the narration. And I thought, I have never seen a movie like this. This is fascinating. Hmm. I don't know what I would have felt if I had watched the whole movie, but that was indelible for me. I knew this was something special, and I still feel that way. I guess what I'm saying is, I saw it in its diminished version, but I still realize it was a great movie.
Yeah. And I think that begs the question. I'm going to give you a hypothetical here, but if you knew nothing about Wells or the history of the film, just pretend them for a moment here, and you saw it fresh for the first time today, do you think you'd consider it an all-time classic, or does it require knowing the background context to appreciate it fully?
Well, I gave you the example of my first time seeing it because I didn't know anything about Wells or anything about the background context of the film. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I knew something about Wells. When I was a kid, I used to be a magician, and I knew that Wells was a magician. So I was interested in Wells. I have always liked the film, and maybe other people haven't. I think knowing how it was butchered is important because you can really appreciate what a huge blow this was for Wells. I think this was maybe the most wounding event in his entire career.
I guess the question, it kind of supposes, if you were to recommend this to somebody who knows very little about Wells, had never seen Amberson's, does it require an explanation? Does it require that context given in terms of how the movie was truncated and butchered? If you didn't say anything to the friend you recommended it to, perhaps the friend may not appreciate it as fully.
I think it's fair to say, but I'm not sure I would go into a long discussion about how the film was butchered. I would just want them to see the film.
You don't want to lose them, right?
I just want them to watch the movie and see what they think. But yeah, I think it's still a pretty powerful film, even in this version.
Yeah, we're on the same page here. This is an 80th birthday celebration, Jim, and it's customary to give presents on birthdays, except I always say in every episode that it's the fans who continue to get the gifts. So, Jim, what is The Magnificent Amberson's greatest gift to viewers?
I think implicitly we've already answered that question. I mean, it is one of the most brilliantly directed and acted and shaped discussions of a historical moment that we have in the movies. And I think the fact that it was deeply personal for Wells still comes across. I think his fondness for it does. But the film is there. That's the gift.
It exists. And that could be more than enough as a gift. Mm-hmm. But if you ask me, here's my answer to the question, Jim. I think the film's greatest gift is that it demonstrates, even 80 years later, that tremendous talent, creativity, ingenuity, artistry, it can't be denied. Is Amberson's a blemished magnum opus because roughly one-third of its footage is missing? Yes. Would the narrative flow better and the character arcs feel more complete if Wells' intended cut survived? Most certainly. Would many of us regard Amberson's as a work equal to or greater than Kane if the missing 43 minutes were put back in? Quite possibly. But as it stands, the uneven existing version remains a monumental achievement to me because of the undeniable quality permeating every frame. Even in this compromised form, the movie is simply too good to fail, I think. And thanks to the exceptional skills of its collaborators, that bears true. The 88-minute version that survives isn't merely better than no version at all. It's better than the vast majority of motion pictures, period. And that's more than good enough for me. Even if I go to my grave never laying eyes on that elusive lost footage, we'll at least have this cut, and I'm happy with it. So, Jim, are you working on anything new that you'd like listeners to know about, such as a forthcoming book, maybe a documentary appearance or speaking engagement?
Well, I just finished writing a book that's published by Oxford. It came out a couple of months ago. It's about Cary Grant, and it's a discussion of Grant as an actor.
And what's the title of the book?
It's called Some Versions of Cary Grant. It's kind of close readings of 11 films that he was in. And I'm really talking about what him as a really important movie star and artist.
Mm.
Just before that, I did a thing for the BFI with those little BFI classics. I don't know if you've ever seen those books.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I did that on one of my favorite movies, A Letter from an Unknown Woman, the Max O'Fools movie.
Okay.
And right now, the BFI has asked me to revise and expand my book about Stanley Kubrick.
Okay.
I'm doing that. It'll be a revised, corrected, expanded version of the book. The book is called On Kubrick. And then my wife and I have long wanted to collaborate. She's a great authority on Brazil and Portugal and has written expansively about a lot of things. But we are hoping to collaborate on a book about the Portuguese film director, Pedro Costa. He deserves a book-length study that's really good, I think. And that's what we're hoping to do.
Wow, very intriguing. And how about audio commentaries? Any more coming up that you can spill the beans on?
No. Unfortunately, they haven't asked me lately. Jonathan Rosenbaum and I think the last one we did was a track on Citizen Kane. So
yeah, no, I really like when you two team up. Good chemistry there. So hopefully they'll be coming out with maybe The Trial or something else, and they'll look you two up.
Yeah.
We'll look forward to those things. So thanks for giving us a heads up on some things you're working on. And Jim, I just want to personally thank you again for taking the time to talk with us here on The Magnificent Ambersons, and wish you well, good health, and good movie watching.
The same to you, Eric.
So thrilled. I finally got an opportunity to confer with Jim Naramore, a man I have long admired and wanted to have on the show. Okay, next, I'm excited to share a conversation I had with Joshua Grossberg, who shed some light on his upcoming Ambersons documentary. It's my pleasure to introduce Joshua Grossberg, an award-winning New York-based filmmaker and journalist specializing in documentaries, commercials, short films, industrials, and branded content for TV and the web. Josh is currently in production on the forthcoming documentary called The Search for the Lost Print, which will detail his 25-year quest to find the original working print of the Magnificent Ambersons. Josh, a big warm hello and welcome to Cineversary.
Thank you, Eric. It's really great to be here. Let me just also mention that the film is now titled The Lost Print, The Making of Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons.
Thank you for the update. Yeah, no, any update is appreciated. Looking forward to this and getting some more details as you are at liberty to share them or not. To set the scene, Josh, can you provide for us a brief synopsis about what happened to the original cut of The Magnificent Ambersons and you know, kind of how, when, and why RKO Studios they edited Welles' version. So he's working for RKO. He chooses Ambersons as his second project to follow up to Kane.
Right.
And then take us from A to B to C so listeners understand better the context, the background of how this became a truncated, compromised cut that we have today.
Sure. So basically RKO announced that The Magnificent Ambersons was going to be Welles' follow-up film after RKO's head, George Schaefer, had listened to the radio drama that Welles had produced on October 29th, 1939. And so production on Ambersons took place between October 1941 and January 1942. And it was mostly uneventful. I mean, Welles was frustrated maybe by the slow pace of his cinematographer, Stanley Cortez, who replaced Greg Tolan because Greg Tolan was unavailable. In fact, actually, Welles later sidelined Cortez just to move things along. But basically, by December, Nelson Rockefeller, who was on RKO's board. At the time, he was Roosevelt's man in charge of the Office of the Coordinator of Inter-American Affairs. That basically oversaw South American relations. There was an effort by the U.S. government to really promote American or Pan-American ties because no one wanted Brazil to be joining, you know, the Axis powers,
right,
or Argentina for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
There was this idea that, you know, Carnival was coming up in February, and Rockefeller suggested Welles would be the perfect man to go down and shoot a film on behalf of the State Department, a diplomatic mission, but in the form of filmmaking. And this would really strengthen U.S. Latin American ties. So Wells, for one, he was taking a lot of heat from William Randolph Hearst. You know, his press, a lot of Hearst's allies who hated him for, you know, what he basically did with Hearst and Citizen Kane. And they were calling for him to be drafted, like the American Foreign Legion. They were trying to get the U.S. government to do this. And part of this was Wells thought, you know, this is a great opportunity of course, to serve his country, but also to prove his patriotism and maybe get a little bit of that heat off of him. At the same time, though, he knew he was editing Amberson's, and that was a problem because he was filming Amberson's by day and starring in Journey into Fear by Night, which was another Mercury production. So he had a lot going on.
If I could stop you briefly, I'm curious about something. Maybe you know the answer.
Sure.
Wells did have an opportunity to say no to this request, right? Or was there such extreme heat from the studio and the government that he just basically couldn't say no?
I think he was in a very difficult political position. I mean, there was talk, you know, accusations that he was a communist, and he was a very progressive man. I mean, really standing up for African-American rights, you know, in the theater. He had the first all black Shakespearean production in Harlem in 1938. Right. Mm-hmm. So this was an opportunity also. And also, he couldn't really fight in the war. He had flat feet. There were some medical conditions he had. So it really made sense for him to do this. And he was getting a lot of pressure to do it.
Plus, he would be so great just to stay home and help serve on the propaganda arm, because I know he appeared in many radio broadcasts, for example, that promoted the war effort.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he hastily agreed, and basically he had to get down by February to Brazil for Carnival and start shooting immediately. And anybody that's seen It's All True, the unfinished film, kind of knows a little bit about that. But what happened was, in terms of Amberson's, he and Robert Wise, his editor, they traveled to Miami, where they spent like a 3-day marathon to finish his cut. And I should say finish is a bit of a misnomer, because he was still going to work on the cut with Wise in Rio. And so in Miami, they recorded a lot of narration, and he got all that done. And what was ostensibly a 131-minute cut. And then he got on the plane and flew down to Rio, and then Wise went back to L.A. But unfortunately, Wise was not able to go to Rio because of wartime restrictions. That was a real problem.
Right.
And so essentially, Wise, on March 11th, sent a print down to Wells. And this print was what they finished in Miami of the original 131 minutes. What I'll say from here forward is the 131, or the original version. Of course, again, he didn't quite finish it. He was still going to work on it.
But it's important for listeners to know that 131-minute Holy Grail version was approved by Wells. Even though he had to make some trims he might not have liked, he still had final cut on that cut.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I will point out that, you know, under his contract, he didn't have director's cut on this, because to get the budget, he basically had to give that up. He didn't have final cut like he did on Citizen Kane, but he very much had approval in terms of the cut that was going to be screened as part of previews.
Okay.
Now, what happened, and where things take a disastrous turn, was on March 17th, RKO decides to screen a version of the cut in Pomona, and then on March 19th in Pasadena. And that first Pomona preview was just a catastrophe, according to Robert Wise and RKO. And
again, just so we're clear, that preview cut was the 131-minute cut. There weren't different versions of the film that existed to this point. It was just that cut, correct?
Not necessarily. There was some material that Wise removed from the cut at the last minute.
Interesting.
And
okay.
But basically, the stuff that people were shown, first of all, they're showing a film, a slow burn Chekhovian drama, after a musical, a raucous musical called The Fleet's Inn. And to imagine, it's a mostly young audience. They need to get away from the war. They're seeing this musical, and suddenly you're getting a very slow burn, very artistic drama. I mean, for Hollywood at the time, it was just, you know, you're not really used to seeing this kind of film. It was so well crafted. Mm. And it's from the man who did Citizen Kane, but it's also about this American family at the turn of the century And it's an indictment about the automobile and progress. So to these folks, it's like it felt out of step with America, which was mobilizing its industry for war, right?
Yeah, good point, right?
So and anyway, what ended up happening was Wise put some of the stuff he took out back into the cut, and they screened it in Pasadena. And that was a little bit better. And by the way, the preview cards in the first test screening weren't as terrible as people make it out to be. There was a number of people that said it was a masterpiece, one of the greatest films they ever saw. But to be fair, Wise did see a lot of people walk out, you know, he said in droves. But we all know test screenings are not the most reliable predictor of how a film will do, certainly. Right. So anyway, at this point, RKO goes into panic mode because they have a lot riding on this. The film was budgeted at $853,000. It went over budget just by a little bit. Really not as much, no differently than like, say, Gunga Din. But in reality, they ordered Wise to cut the film down. And so that ultimate like 131-minute cut that Wells had finished was now being truncated, and new scenes had to be rewritten by the studio.
Now, if I could take you back 1 second, you said they ordered Wise to do it. Why didn't they order Wells directly? Or was Wise just basically a conduit between the two?
Wise effectively answered to the studio. And there was another guy named Jack Moss, who was Wells's business manager. He was there essentially to look after Wells's interests. Unfortunately, this is a tough thing because Wells was not able to be there to fight for his vision of the film. Mm-hmm. He's communicating by cable while he's working 20 hours a day shooting It's All True in the carnival sequence. Right. He can't juggle all this, and he's doing his best. He sent pages upon pages of suggested edits upon learning of this preview, which, by the way, he didn't authorize because the film wasn't ready for test screenings yet. Mm-hmm. But George Schaefer wanted to get the film out for Easter. So you have this problem whereby he's trying to save the picture from thousands of miles away. And Jack Moss, for that matter, Cy Enfield, who would later go on to become a notable Hollywood director, he was working as an assistant to Wells at the time. He was at the Mercury office, and he actually saw Wells's pages of cables in terms of suggested edits. And he saw Jack Moss throw that paper into the trash can. Ugh. Wells was essentially ignored, even by his own man. And that's the real crime of it, is he didn't really get a chance to at least to put his, I guess, genius to use in terms of, all right, there's a problem. How can I fix it but still adhere to my vision? Hmm. And so what ended up happening was RKO and Wise basically figured out a way to truncate certain scenes. And so they brought in Freddie Fleck, the assistant director, and basically reshot some of those scenes, including a very tonally awkward upbeat ending, like the classic Hollywood ending. And as you can imagine, you're watching a slow Chekhovian type drama about the dissolution of this aristocratic American family. And then suddenly there's this happy ending piled on top, and it just was disjointed.
Yeah, non sequitur.
The whole act three just really, it's not what Wells's vision was, although the first two acts really did capture what he was doing and, for the most part, leave what he did untouched.
Although it's also important for listeners to know, it's not just that ending that is so abrupt and awkward and out of place. There were 43 minutes, give or take, that were trimmed out. Yeah, the ending is particularly egregious.
It's just a crime, really. I mean, I kind of view this as like Tetris. Like I, you know, ever see somebody play Tetris and you're seeing how the pieces fall and you're like, I can do better than that. Why did they put it together this way? And of course they lose, right? Well, I view this as they didn't know how to play Tetris. And part of like my documentary is it would be nice to see how it would have been pieced together had Wells had that opportunity.
You did a wonderful job summarizing this, but it also sounds like the studio was just kind of exasperated and totally impatient by this point and just kind of wanted to get it out there and quit wasting time and resources on it. So like, Robert, you know, edit it up, get it done. Let's just get it out.
Right.
Is that a fair assessment of why they didn't really pay a lot of close attention to it?
Well, there's that. And there's also some machinations that were going on in terms of the board and the leadership under George Schaefer. And we'll get into that in the documentary. I don't want to go into it too much now. But Orson Welles was also a bit of a scapegoat in all of this and an excuse for regime change. Mm-hmm. And that's a fascinating story.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch and learn more about that in your forthcoming doc. So yeah, thank you. Masterful job of just kind of getting us up to speed here, Josh. Thanks so much.
Sure.
So what can you tell us without, you know, giving away the farm on your documentary content, but what do we know about the 43 minutes that were trimmed out? Are there any other exciting things in the 43 minutes that are lost that you would be salivating over to see?
Sure. Well, let me start with probably the biggest technical loss in the missing 43 minutes that we don't have is the full continuous 10-minute one take. This was an extraordinary feat of technical ingenuity. You know, one of the most expensive line items in the film was...
You're talking about the ballroom sequence, right?
Correct. The ballroom sequence. Mm-hmm. And the mansion, the Ambersons mansion, was the most expensive part of the production. It was probably one of the most expensive sets ever built in the history of Hollywood cinema.
I thought I read some trivia where that cost more than the set for Gone with the Wind or something like that.
No, that's definitely the case. And
that's only 3 years removed, folks. Like, I mean, this is the same era. So
you're seeing the ceilings, which, you know, Wells was very well known for in terms of Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. And he loved to move walls in and out and have the camera just, he loved to use the camera as audaciously as possible. And you're talking about a camera that followed the actors up the stairs into different floors, culminating in this beautiful ballroom sequence where they dance toward the camera, away from the camera. Meanwhile, we're getting bits of dialogue that establishes the characters and more about the relationships and the different generations. And it's really a remarkable piece of cinema.
So Josh, are you saying that he had originally shot a 10-minute unbroken scene? Or was it cleverly disguised like Hitchcock does in Rope?
No. It was about as long as a film mag. And
wow,
they spent a long time choreographing this. RKO thought that he was wasting his time, but then boom, he's getting 10 or 12 pages done in one take. And people had seen it in its original state, it would have been the greatest sequence ever put to screen.
At least up to that time, right?
Up to that time. And it's unfortunate that, unfortunately, Wise and, you know, RKO, to move the film along and get that brevity that they were going for in the 88-minute theatrical release, they cut it up. There's like, I think, 10 or 12 cuts, and it just moves it along faster. But really, you're missing the artistry, the beauty, which really would have immersed you in that world even more. So on a technical, pure cinephile level, like, that's what I want to see, of course.
Oh, that sounds like a worse crime than the ending that was butchered.
I mean, you know, everybody's in love with, say, Touch of Evil in the opening shot, but this was, you know, times 10. But on another level, on a thematic level, I think what's important, you and Jim talked about the boarding house ending a little bit, but thematically, a lot of what was cut out in that 43 minutes was about the themes that are pertinent to the film, which is the idea of, you know, modernity overwhelming this sort of romantic 19th century agrarian past and destroying it. One of the things that's lost from the original version is all the stuff about Major Amberson. Major Amberson, being the family patriarch, had to sell parts of their land in order to pay off the debts. And so you really get a lot of that kind of information in the moments that are cut from the film that makes the film very disjointed in the third act.
Absolutely. It's so much more resonant what you're saying because it's glossed over in the 88-minute print. In which suddenly they're broke.
Right.
And,
yeah, exactly.
And we don't necessarily know why. We just hear some quick references to, you know, bad investments and this and that, but really not much context.
Yeah, you don't get the nuance or the drama concerning the impact of what of those forces, you know, and and basically what we're seeing is just this sudden arrival of cold steel at the factories and the noise of the automobiles in the elevated trains. Even like the last shot of the film deals with that in the original version.
Right.
That's just completely gone. And what you're left with is sort of this bratty kid who gets his comeuppance, which if you know a little bit more of the context, you can appreciate this film so much more because it says so much about environmental degradation. You know, it's really ahead of its time in its critique of American progress or modernity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And I know that Jim was passionate in his assessment of how, you know, the studio basically in its efforts to cut this up really primarily focused on the love story angle at the expense of all these other themes that you and he were talking about.
Right. I mean, the only other filmmaker making any sort of critique like this in a mainstream film at the time was maybe Charlie Chaplin, you know, in modern times. I mean, that's just how radical a vision, you know, Wells was presenting. And it's really remarkable.
Yeah. So that's a good kind of A to B. But now, why did so many people believe that the cut footage, the 131-minute print, survived and could possibly found in Brazil? Obviously, Wells was in Brazil. We get that. But why do people, why have they believed that this cut still exists?
That's a great question. And I think partly, you know, everyone loves a good adventure story, right? And there's something mysterious about this missing, lost work of art. And really, for one, there's no evidence that the print was truly destroyed. There's no record that said this person was here and we definitely, you know, burned it, we threw it in the water, whatever.
But what's the proof that it did exist, though? Was it just anecdotal kind of evidence, or do we actually have a paper trail that shows that those tins of film arrived in Brazil?
I will go into that in the doc, but okay. I can say that there is a, you know, records pertaining to
gotcha.
That. Mm-hmm. And but basically, you know, I think a lot of people find it hard that RKO would just sort of nilly-willy go and destroy the footage of a master filmmaker. You know, this is Orson Welles. But we have to remember that back in that time, it was fairly standard to get rid of excess film that never made the final release. And so studios routinely ordered it. You know, they weren't sitting around thinking, oh, let's hold on to it in case we want to make Blade Runner the ultimate cut or Zack Snyder's the Snyder cut. You know what I mean? So when studio, it just wasn't in their even scope to think that it might be useful one day.
Do you think that they also adopted a vitriolic attitude toward Welles, even his own studios, where let's screw this guy over. Let's actually destroy his leftover footage here.
I don't necessarily think that's the case. Okay. I think it's more, they did get into some legal tussles, which okay. we'll go into in the film. But I think it's just business. You know, it's just business, Sonny, as they say in The Godfather. But anyway, but look, the other hope that it could be found is because other films have been. You know, we look at Metropolis, a version of Metropolis that was 30 minutes longer than the release was found in an Argentine museum. We're talking South America. You're looking at The Passion of Joan of Arc, the original Carl Dreyer cut, mm-hmm. was found in an insane asylum in Denmark, I believe. So
even Too Much Johnson, which was recently found, that very early Welles film.
Right, in 2008 in an Italian mm-hmm. warehouse. So, I think that's why people feel that way.
So why and how did you personally decide to begin searching for the lost footage from The Magnificent Ambersons and create a documentary to trace this effort? So get us up to speed on how and when you began this. Now, according to your bio that I read, it's been a 25-year plus kind of odyssey for you. So does it really go back that far?
It does. If you can believe it, to 1994, I was a student at Northwestern University, and in my dorm, a film mentor of mine who was the associate master named Rich Johnson, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And he was just brilliant. And he would screen all these wonderful classics, and he screened Ambersons. And I have to admit that the first time I saw it, I was like, I just don't see why this is what you're seeing. He really thought it was a masterpiece. But then I watched it again and we got to talking, and he told me a story about the making, and I understood a little bit more of the context. And I started looking into it. And as it so happened, I had been on a cruise the summer before and met all these Brazilians. And my roommate and I had talked about going to Brazil and just traveling around. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to look into this idea of this lost print. And I happened to be working at Jersey Films that summer. I was an intern. That was Danny DeVito's company. And a woman that worked there had worked on It's All True. And so I called her up. Her name was Joelle Bentalila. And she put me in touch with Bill Crone, the co-director of It's All True. And Bill was very kind. And he gave me the number of a Brazilian filmmaker named Rogério Gonzalez. Rogério had done a number of biographical films on Welles. On Christmas Day in 1994, I showed up at Rogério's doorstep in Rio, told him I'm a friend of Bill Crone's. And I really barely knew Bill at the time. And, you know, I said, I want to talk to you about the lost print. And he looked at me like I was nuts, but he said, come up to the roof and let's have a beer. And so we sat on the roof till like 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. and drank beers and talked film and talked Welles. And by the end of it, he said, I want you to stay with me. I have an idea. I think we should look into this. And so I stayed about another week in Rio, and he took me around to all the sites where Welles had filmed and, you know, filmed the carnival and It's All True. And it was really amazing. Rogério, who unfortunately is also no longer with us, was a brilliant, brilliant filmmaker. It was a real honor. And at that point, we met with a friend of his, this archivist named Michelle. And Michelle had claimed, and I was shocked, and so was Rogério for that matter. Michelle had claimed to have seen canisters belonging to Welles in the late 50s or early 60s in an archive. And that it's possible it could have been Amberson's. And I looked at Rogerio because I'm like, is this guy putting us on? But Rogerio said that, you know, he's known Michelle a long time. And this was something that I think Michelle was serious about. And so he actually had given us the names of several collectors to look up. And so part of the leads that I have in this documentary and this film is about me exploring these leads and some others that we've found since, putting us on the trail of the lost prince.
Amazing. Talk about passion for your art. I mean, you followed your desire for all these decades now.
Let me add one thing, though. When I got back to Chicago, I did try and make this film years earlier. I applied for grant after grant after grant. But it back then, this was pre-internet. There was no Kickstarter and it was near impossible. But the story has just stayed with me and I've been interviewed over the years about it. And finally had the opportunity over the past couple of years after The Other Side of the Wind premiered on Netflix, there was renewed interest. And that's where TCM came aboard and sponsored my expedition last fall to Brazil to hunt for the script.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. So is there anything else you can share? I know that you're trying to keep a lid on what exactly you might have found or not found. I get that the documentary is imminent and forthcoming here. Mm-hmm. But is there anything you could share with the listeners about your search or the forthcoming doc that we would love to know about? For example, do we know of a release date yet? How will listeners be able to watch it? And what can they expect to learn in watching the documentary?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, I really can't say much. But we're excited to finish up the documentary. And Wells fans and cinephiles in due course will be interested to hear what we found, trust me. Like, I'm definitely pleased to say, though, we recently brought aboard French producer Alain Girard, who executive produced The March of the Penguins. He's just come aboard, and we have a lot of interest in Europe for this film as well. You know, obviously, Wells was very popular in France and Spain and Italy. But if all goes according to plan, I can definitely tell you The Lost Print will be finished by early next year and will premiere at a major festival as well as be seen on TCM.
Okay, gotcha. Because I know that there were initial kind of reports about it being released this year in celebration of the 80th anniversary, but the gel hasn't quite gelled, if you will.
Eric, as you and Orson and probably every other filmmaker knows, making movies is a very arduous process, and we're getting there.
Yes, right. No, it makes sense. Absolutely. Okay, I have to ask a tough question, and I respect if you have to decline. But I would assume that if you did find something substantial by now, we would have known about it. Is that fair to say?
I can't really answer that except to say, I mean, anything that turns up would be amazing and contribute to, I think, a better understanding of, you know, Wells and his original vision for Amberson's. Yeah.
But okay. No, that's totally fair. So let me ask you some hypotheticals. And again, it doesn't mean that if you answer the question, you're confirming yes or no. It's pure hypothetical. Okay, Josh, assuming you're still hunting for the footage, what if you were only able to find or recover portions of the missing scenes? In that sense, can and will an extended cut of Amberson's be created that lacks all 43 missing minutes? So have you thought about the possibility that, wow, I might find something, but maybe I only find snippets or portions that can be actually restored or recovered, in which case I guess something is better than nothing, I would assume the answer would be, right?
Let me put it this way. What's the meaning of Rosebud? You know, I mean, whether or not we present new footage, my team, we've been conducting this amazing investigation, and at a minimum, we're going to tell you the fate of the 131.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, as cinephiles know, making a documentary, we're also reconstructing a classic film and, you know, let alone restoring one, that could take time as well. But
absolutely,
as I said, you know, I expect by middle of next year, you guys will see the result.
Right. And I would assume that that deadline could get extended if maybe leads turn out to be more positive than you think. And of course, I assume even if you don't find any of the missing footage, there's still a fascinating story to be told about the making of and the loss of the Wells cut of The Magnificent Amberson. So if that alone is what constitutes a documentary, sign me up, brother, because I'm riveted to know more about that story.
That's great to hear. Look, you know, this is Wells' Lost Eden. This film represents his most personal vision. Mm-hmm. And I think it's out there waiting to be rediscovered. And I think at the very least, you know, I think if we can achieve that, then audiences will come away with a whole new view of Orson as an artist and as a man.
Yeah, just reading between the lines, I'm going to take it as a positive sign that it hasn't been released yet this year. I'm going to hold out hope that maybe, just maybe, that Holy Grail is within reach somehow, and that's why things got kicked down to 2023. So why should viewers watch, love, and appreciate The Magnificent Ambersons, even in its flawed current state? So what's your argument here for, look, even if it's never restored to its 131-minute version, the version we have now is great because why, Josh?
Because it still packs a punch. I mean, it's the rare film made during Hollywood studio system that, you know, gives people a mature artistic vision that stands out from a lot of the stuff in that era. I mean, even in its flawed form, it's a film that critiqued the direction America was headed in and the world. And it's a film that, as I said before, it has an environmental theme to it because we're talking about the disappearance of old America and the agrarian lifestyle. And it ushers in the age of modernity where people are now traveling in cars. And, you know, I mean, look, the last 100 years have, if you think about it, the amazing changes that this country, the world for that matter, has undergone. I mean, this was a film that was talking about that stuff 80 years ago. No other film at that time was really doing it like Wells was doing it.
Very ahead of its time.
And, you know, I think, for that matter, it's actually a subversive piece of cinema. You know, that's another reason to really treasure it.
Well said. Totally agree. What is The Magnificent Ambersons' greatest gift to viewers?
Yeah, I like to think about something that the late Peter Bogdanovich told me. He was an advisor on this project, by the way, up until his passing earlier this year.
Okay.
But he said that, you know, even if Wells had never made another film besides Citizen Kane, his place as one of the greats in cinema history is assured. And so to me, like, you know, having Ambersons around, even in its truncated form, it just gives us a glimpse of the artist that Wells becomes in the years after he left Hollywood. I mean, it really is a symbol of that transformation where he evolved into a different kind of artist. I don't think it's anything less. I mean, yes, he had to struggle to make other films like, you know, F for Fake and Othello, but nonetheless, he was still doing groundbreaking work that should be celebrated.
So, Josh, anything else in the works that you'd like listeners to know about?
There are a few things in the works, to be sure. Well, I've got a narrative feature that I'm working on that I hope to shoot right after this, once this is done. Mm-hmm. A few television things. I do want to just say to all the Wells fans that have reached out to us and that have been supporting us, and all cinephiles, really, I want to thank them for all the support and the nice, kind messages we've gotten. It's for the love of Wells that we do this. I mean, we want to keep his legacy alive.
Certainly.
I also want to just do a quick shout out to WellsNet. Anything and everything you need to know about Orson Welles, go to WellsNet.
Hear, hear.
And to all the great biographers, Joe McBride and Jim and Simon Callow, all those people that are really showing who Welles is. You know, Joe McBride likes to say we're VISTO, Volunteers in the Service of Orson Welles.
I like it. Good acronym.
And I agree wholeheartedly with that sentiment. So it's a real treat to do this.
Yeah, sign me up. I'll become a member. Well, Josh, best of luck in your pursuits with this project and any others forthcoming, and our unbound appreciation for appearing on Cineversary.
Oh, thank you, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I wasn't exactly holding my breath that Josh would be able to reveal every crucial detail about his search for the Ambersons footage or the impending doc, but it was wonderful being able to converse with him about his efforts and what he loves about The Magnificent Ambersons. So again, our thanks, Josh. Time now for standing ovations. This is where I give a shout-out to a film, website, book, television program, podcast, or other work that I think would be of interest to classic film lovers just like you. For August, I'm going to spread a wide net and name-drop several boutique labels that continue to release home video versions of vintage, cult, rare, and overlooked films on Blu-ray, Ultra HD Blu-ray, and DVD that I believe are worth your attention. I know we live in a streaming-dominated world today, where even classic movies can consistently be watched on demand via the likes of, you know, TCM and the Criterion Channel. But let's not bury physical media just yet. Despite faltering sales of and increasing disinterest in video discs, there are still wonderful examples of smaller companies releasing quality versions of beloved movies on Blu-ray and DVD And not just the Criterion Collection and Kino Lorber. There are several boutique labels that continue to put TLC into physical media distribution of desirable titles available in Region A releases that can be played right here in the States. So in case you weren't aware, let me bring to your attention first the efforts of Shout Factory, which has a vast library of films it issues and reissues. 4K collectors in particular will appreciate Shout's recent special editions of The Last Detail, Army of Darkness, Platoon, Child's Play, JFK, and the Cat People remake. Then there's Arrow Video, a British independent distributor of world cinema, cult, B-movie, art, horror, and classic films on Ultra HD Blu-ray, Blu-ray, and DVD. This is another great example of the little engine that could. They've recently put out deluxe editions of, for instance, Legend, David Lynch's Dune, RoboCop, and True Romance. Another label worth your time is Powerhouse Films' Indicator series. They boast limited edition box sets and single title releases packed with extras. Its region-free slate includes Body Double, Birdie, 20 Million Miles to Earth, Christine, and The Big Heat, most of which I own and highly recommend. If cult flicks, grindhouse, and modern horror are more your flavor, well, check out Vinegar Syndrome, which has put out shiny new editions of The Incredible Melting Man, Death Wish 2, and Dolomite, among others. And the praise doesn't stop there, folks. Other labels you might want to keep on your radar include The Film Detective, Flicker Alley, and, of course, the Warner Archive Collection. If you happen to own a region-free player, you can dabble in many overseas labels that only feature, for example, Region B titles, like Eureka and its Masters of Cinema line, or BFI Blu-rays. So don't abandon ship prematurely on disc-driven media. If you want to own the highest quality versions of some of your favorite past films without having to worry about that title disappearing from your streaming channel watch list, always a threat, look into labels like these and the titles they offer and help keep physical media alive, please. Like what you hear on Cineversary? We'd love to get your feedback. Whether you want to nominate a movie for a future anniversary episode, provide comments, or just have a question, get a hold of us at cineversegroup@gmail.com. That's C-I-N-E-V-E-R-S-E group@gmail.com. Also, you can really help our show grow by spreading the good word about the Cineversary podcast to your friends and loved ones. Even better, please leave a positive online review and rating, which significantly helps us get discovered by new listeners. So if you use Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or CastBox, simply search for the Cineversary page, look for a link that says something like ratings or reviews, click that, and leave that rating or review. While you're at it, take a moment to like us on Facebook, too. And if you'd like to go an extra step and help keep our show ad-free, consider making a donation to the Cineversary podcast by visiting tinyurl.com/donatecineversary. We really appreciate your support. Lastly, we encourage you to visit cineversegroup.com. That's the portal for my private film discussion group I launched back in 2005, where you can hear recordings of our group discussions and read in-depth analyses about the different movies we study. It has been too long since our show has featured a proper film noir from Hollywood's golden age. So next month, we will correct that hiatus by sending 75th birthday wishes to one of the noirest of them all. In September, we spotlight Out of the Past, directed by Jacques Tourneur, which made its debut in late 1947. Until next time, this is your humble host, Eric Martin, reminding you to butter up that popcorn, live a big screen surround sound life, and cherish those classic movies, because they are not getting older. They're getting more magnificent. Thanks as ever for giving us a listen.